We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
The word deacon means minister or servant. Thus, in the New Testament, it's not used often as a particular job, but it is often used of service in general. Jesus comes not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Which, in quaint English, I suppose, is that Jesus came not to be deaconed, or deaconed to, but to deacon. He has the job and role of serving. And the word that is used, the verb form of it's used there, is that of deaconing. In Acts chapter 6, there are a group of seven men who are set aside to serve. They're set aside to deacon, especially in financial administration amongst the widows. If you remember, there was some dispute arose between different groups of widows within the Jerusalemite church, and they appoint seven men to spare the apostles of this particular ministry and to undertake the service. They are never called deacons, but they do serve. In Philippians chapter 1 and the first verse of it, Paul writes to the church in Philippi, but he writes to the overseers and to the deacons, as if there is a particular group of people with this function of being servants, of being ministers, of being deacons. And here in 1 Timothy chapter 3 verse 8 and again in verse 12, we read of a group of people who are called deacons. And we're given certain instructions concerning the deacons. And they're very similar instructions to the ones we saw last week in the first seven verses of the chapter, the instructions for the qualifications of overseers. But precisely what they were, or who they were, what they did, is not spelled out for us here. Paul knew what the church structures of the first century were, and Timothy knew what they were, but they didn't bother telling us, and so we don't know. We don't know who deacons were, we don't know what they did, and we don't know where they fitted much into the structures of church life. Now that gives us a small problem, because most church traditions maintain a group of people they call deacons. You have deacons in the Church of England. In fact, I was one myself for 12 months. You have to be a deacon for 12 months before you can get ordained as a presbyter, as a priest within the Church of England. So all ministers in the Church of England go through 12 months as being deacons. But no one ever sure what you're supposed to do or not do as a deacon. They're non-people, actually. You have them in the Greek Orthodox tradition, they stay on for life. You have them within the Roman Catholicism, you have them within the Baptist circles. All traditions have deacons. But of course every tradition does a different thing with its deacons. There are different qualifications, there are different jobs, there are different tasks. Well, that's to be expected, because there's no set out anywhere as to what a deacon's supposed to do. What is a problem with the church is that they all think that what their group of deacons do is what the New Testament did. But you can never know that. There's no way you'll ever know that, because we don't know what the New Testament deacons did. However, we do know that they were involved in Christian service, because that's the very nature of the word. And we talk even further of serving well down in verse 13 of our passage today. And it may have been in that financial administration of welfare work, such as the deacons were in Acts chapter 6, and such as the only other possible deacon we have in the New Testament, Phoebe, in Romans chapter 16 and verse 1. She was involved, I think, in such patronage, which raises an even more difficult question for us on today's passage. Who are the women in verse 11? In the same way, their wives, or the women, are to be women worthy of respect, not malicious talkers, etc. Who are these women that come halfway through the deacon instructions. The advice concerning them is the same as the advice given for the overseers and for the deacons. But who were they? It could be women in general, or it could be the wives of the deacons, Mrs. Deacon, or it could be the women deacons, that is, the deaconesses. I think the first alternative, the women in general, is most unlikely, because the context is not dealing with women in general, but rather it's the context of overseers and deacons, of people with particular tasks and functions. But that leaves it could be the wives of the deacons, or it could be the deaconesses. And you see, if you've got a New International Version of the Bible, that those two alternatives are put for you, in one in the text and the other in a footnote. Mine is footnote C. And it could be either of those. The choice between those two cannot be resolved as far as I can see. Personally, I prefer the idea that it's the deaconesses. But that, I presume, is really a prejudice on my part. I'm not sure that you can prove it. I'm not sure I can prove it. And so throughout the rest of the sermon, I'll talk about the women. And if you think it's the deaconesses, then you apply it to the deaconesses. And if you think it's the wives of the deacons, then you apply it to the wives of the deacons. And if you're like me, you can't make up your mind, then apply it to both, just in case. More important question that's still unresolved is, what do these people do? The deacons and the women. It is a work of service. It is not the work of ruling the household, for that is the work of the overseer, who is distinguished from them. But rather, I presume, it's the administrator, especially the waiter on tables, the dispenser of poor relief and the like, is the most likely candidate. But I don't think we should limit it, but rather leave it as one who is appointed as a servant within the congregation. For if it had mattered to God that we know precisely the church structures that are the church structures, then he would have written to us on such a subject. The fact that it is all remains ignorant seems to me an indication that it doesn't matter, that there is no one church structure which is the church structure. What is important is that those who serve the congregation have these kinds of qualifications, whatever the particular kind of service they're engaged in, the specific structures in which they serve. Those things don't matter, but the kind of person who does the serving, he or she matters enormously. So we see that the passage really is about the qualifications of the servants. Firstly, notice that their qualifications were to be the same as the overseer, the elder. In verse 8 it reads, deacons likewise are to be, and in verse 11, in the same way the women are to be. The women and the deacons are both to be like the overseers in their qualifications. And in fact, when you go through the qualifications, although slightly different wording is used, the same qualifications are required. Notice verse 8, that the deacon is to be a man who is worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, not pursuing dishonest gain. Notice down in verse 12 that he is to be the husband of but one wife and to manage his children and household well. But when you go back to the overseer in verse 2, you'll see the qualifications are basically the same. The overseer must be above reproach, the husband of but one wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to much wine, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome but nor a lover of money. Many of the qualifications are identical. Even the women, in verse 11, have similar qualifications: worthy of respect, temperate, trustworthy, not malicious talkers. For the qualifications of the elder, the deacon, and the women are really the qualifications of the Christian person. They're Christian characteristics rather than skills as such. Last week, I suggested that the only skill required in the elder is that he must be an apt teacher. He must be able to teach. All the other qualifications that are listed for us, are just general Christian characteristics. All Christians should be temperate and self-controlled and respectable and hospitable. That is the character of Christian living. Doesn't make them of Christians, of course. But if we are Christians, then they are the kinds of things we should aspire to. And so the elder is appointed as one who fits the bill as the Christian model. Yet there are differences between the overseers and the deacons and the women. For the deacons are not required to have the special gift of teaching. That's not to say they can't teach or they're unable to teach, but that is not a prerequisite of their ministry. And so presumably their ministry is not that of being the teacher any more than it's being the ruler of the household. For it is by teaching that the overseer does rule a household. He's not to be a teacher. Yet he is not to be ignorant of the truths of the gospel. For in fact, verse 9 tells us that he must keep hold the deep truths of the faith with a clear conscience. What then are these deep truths that he is to hold? Something that is not said of the overseer. The word here is the word mystery. It occurs again in our chapter, as we'll see next week, in verse 16. Beyond all question, the mystery of godliness is great. And so we'll be looking at the mystery of the gospel, the deep truths of the gospel, in detail next week. Suffice it to say here that part and parcel of the gospel of Jesus Christ is the news that Jews and Gentiles alike can be in the kingdom of heaven. That is part and parcel of the mystery of the gospel of Jesus. Now, it doesn't seem like much of a mystery to us. It doesn't seem like much of a deep truth to us. But that is because we haven't grown up with a sufficiently Jewish background, or at least most of us haven't. For within the context of the Old Testament and its covenant, there was no indication that those outside of Israel could ever really come into the kingdom of heaven. There are certain hints, there are certain hopes and aspirations, there are certain desires for the great time in the future when the Gentiles will come and show homage to the Jewish nation, but you're not reasonably expecting the Messiah to be the Messiah for all peoples and Gentiles. While that was there in the Old Testament, it wasn't there in Jewish thinking. Indeed, the separation between Jew and Gentile seemed to be an unbridgeable gulf. It almost as if they weren't both humans. The Gentiles were viewed as being without God and without hope. Hopeless atheists is how the New Testament Jews would have thought of the Gentiles. But yet, the great truth of the gospel is that in Jesus Christ, the Gentiles, the pagans, the hopeless atheists can now become dwellers in the kingdom of God, can now become the sons and daughters of God, can now become the children of Abraham. That is a radical thought, and it is a mystery that is kept hidden until the Apostle Paul. Now, it is very important that those who serve the congregation understand that mystery. Otherwise, in a congregation mixed people of Jews and Gentiles, as the first century congregations were, there would be great temptation to show favouritism. If you believe that it really was a matter of Judaism and Gentiles got in as second-class citizens, then you would be tempted to favour the Jewish Christians rather than caring for the Gentiles in their need as well. If you remember back in Acts chapter 6, it was the very question of division between the Greek-speaking Jews and the Hebrew-speaking Jews that led to the establishment of these servants to make sure that all the widows were being cared for. Racial prejudices, national prejudices, are very deep in many of us. And if we're going to have a servant who cares for all the congregation, they must be one who is free from any of that kind of partiality, that bias, so that he can serve each and every member, especially when it has theological overtones, such as the distinction between Israel and the Gentiles. So that is an important qualification of the deacons. But while we've got a list of here of qualifications, there is something else Paul is teaching. It's not only who should be appointed, but how we go about appointing such people. Verse 10 insists that we appoint them only after testing. Most of us who have been raised through the Department of Education in this fair land know that all tests are designed to fail us, and therefore live in horror and dread of the whole concept of testing at any time. Not so the word that is here. The idea is here is not that we may fail many, but that we may pass many. But that we pass them having examined them, having looked at their lives to see that they fulfil the prerequisites, having seen them fulfil small responsibilities before encharging them with larger responsibilities. We should actually test them, though. They must first be tested, and then if there is nothing against them, let them serve as deacons. There is advantage in democracy. There is an advantage in that. But there are severe limitations in democracy also, especially in terms of the ability of a popular vote to reflect a testing of a person's godliness and aptitude for a ministry within the congregation. It is so easy for us to see the destruction of God's household through unfit and unworthy servants within that congregation, within congregations. It is critical that we test and evaluate people's lives before we appoint them to service inside a congregation. The way of Christian leadership is service. That is a perverse view that the world never understands, because the way the world leads is by oppression and force and power, by manipulation. But the way in which the Christian leads is by serving, is by laying down his life for his fellow, is by caring for them. And therefore, our leaders must be people who truly reflect the character of the gospel in their public and private lives. And just as it is a good thing for somebody to desire to be an overseer, so there are great rewards in being a servant, in being a deacon. So verse 13 says, those who have served well gain an excellent standing and great assurance in their faith in Christ Jesus. For those who serve well will be well respected by God's people. They will gain within the congregation an excellent standing. For God's people will appreciate their faithfulness, will appreciate their efforts, will appreciate their godliness with which they conduct themselves. People will gain a good standing in our congregation as they serve the congregation. Furthermore, as they give their service to God's people, not only do they gain an excellent standing, but from that too will give them greater confidence as Christians to stand and serve the faith. They won't be timid or circumspect in their service as Christians and in their stand as Christians, but they will be free to work for the Lord with vigour and enthusiasm and confidence, because they have the confidence of God's people and because they have nothing that can be held in accusation against them. So then, what lessons do we draw from this rather strange short passage that we come to today? Five of them that I've listed there. Firstly, in terms of our appointments. We must question our appointments to serve. Taking in its broad terms, from Sunday school teachers to church wardens, and from musicians to staff workers, and all the steps and stages between that you may care to think about. We must pay careful attention to the people whom we appoint to serve our congregation. We must especially pay attention to their Christian suitability. That is more important than the particular gifts they bear, the particular aptitudes that they may have, the capacities they have for particular tasks, or their popularity within the congregation. Popularity and capability are the ways of this world. Godliness is the way of God, and we must look to their godliness that can be seen publicly. Too many churches have appointed people as treasurers and organists, as choir masters and fellowship leaders, whose own personal life, whose own faith in Christ, whose own family life is in ruins. We must test and be assured that godliness is their way of life before we appoint people to their ruin and to the ruin of God's household. That, of course, friends, goes against the strain of most church appointments, doesn't it? For we do it by popularity often, which is very sad, and we're also so keen to get people into service that we do not care for them often enough. Sometimes people are appointed to service in order to help them. That seems to be never a particularly biblical process, but we think it might help them to take on responsibilities. And sometimes, of course, it's with a very new Christian that we do it. We must be concerned for their godliness, that they can be tested and proved to be fit for the tasks to which we've called them. Secondly, what should we look for and pray for and encourage in those who do service? Again, it must be the godly lifestyle, which will give them excellent standing in our eyes. We here should be very thankful to God for the many people who serve our congregation in so many ways. And as we have them, we should pray for them. Not just for their service, but for them, that they may continue in right motives, in sincerity, in being above reproach, that their households will be Christianly managed, that they will serve well and experience the rewards of service so that they may serve even more. Friends, there are so many who are servicing here. Men who count the money, or men and women who count the money after service, people who put out the books and give them to us, those who from ringing the bell, those who are teaching our children at this very moment in Sunday school, those who are playing for us in musical instruments, those who are leading our services, those who are conducting prayer and Bible groups in their homes and leading. There are many people, hundreds of people, in fact, who are serving in many capacities within our congregation. That is a matter of great thankfulness to God. This is no one-man band, and it never should be either. But that means that as we think about people and the work they do for us, that we should pray for them, and especially for their godliness and the rewards that they might reap from their service. Thirdly, we should encourage people into service as we see them passing the tests of Christian suitability. It seems that we as a congregation have a peculiar privilege of many young and gifted people. We must not encourage them into service, but into godliness. But then if they are displaying the signs of God's work in their lives, then of course we must encourage them into the service that will be appropriate and rewarding for them. Fourthly, as with the overseers, Paul is writing into congregational life models of behaviour. We must then set up such models and value that our congregational life will reflect that godly behaviour. Those who hold office amongst us should be models for us of the message we proclaim. We mustn't push it too far, of course, otherwise you'll only get perfect people serving, and then of course no one will serve. That is to push it far beyond what Paul is saying here, and I would resign immediately if that is what is meant, knowing full well that no one else would be able to take my shoes either, because no one else is perfect. But at least in these respects, in the respects of verse 8, being worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in too much wine, not pursuing dishonest gain, at least in the respects of not being malicious talkers but rather being temperate and trustworthy in everything, at least in these kinds of respects, the people we choose to be leaders within the congregational life, because we choose them to be servants in the congregational life, must reflect these values in their life. And therefore, it will be written into our congregational life. There has come to our church on many occasions a girl who sings with the most beautiful voice and sings professionally in different contexts. She offers to sing for us, and I'm sure it would be sweet and beautiful for our ears, and the words of the songs that we would choose for her would indeed be words that would enhance our belief and encourage us in godliness. But she herself does not believe in Jesus. She just likes hanging around with Christian people. And she'd like to thank us by singing for us. If we get her to serve us in such positions of leadership, will she not become a model of our congregational life? That is not the model we want, a first-class singer. That's not the model of congregational life, is it? Model of congregational life must be a believer who happens to sing. We are setting up models in the people we ask to serve us. And therefore, the fifth point, if that is the case, then we should seek to conduct ourselves in a way that is fitting to the model. These overseers and deacons display for us models of conduct. Then we must take such models to heart. It's not just for the deacons and their women, but it is for us that we must not attract disrespect, that we must not be insincere. Rather, we should be sober people, not chasing after the grog, free from the love of money. We must hold on to that mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. And we mustn't be malicious talkers and gossipers, but rather must be temperate people who are thoroughly trustworthy in everything we do. And we must be faithful in our marriages, and we must manage our own household and children well. These are the characteristics for each one of us, for we select our models along these bases, and if we select them as models for us, then we must seek to follow them. For that is what you do with a model. For all of us, therefore, we must work at these lists. For some of us, some of those will be harder than others. But here are the goals and the patterns of behaviour that we must seek to inculcate in our own life and in our congregational life, and specifically in this context, in our leadership, those whom we select to serve us. Do you want to ask questions or make a comment? John asked the question about the phrase, if the deacon is to have one wife. Again, it's like the elders. There are three options. One is to say he's not to be a polygamist, but I don't think that's the case because the widow is only to have had one husband, and there was no polyandry practiced in that period of time in that part of the world. So I don't think it's against polygamy. Secondly, it could be against remarriage after the death of a spouse, but I don't believe that because in 1 Timothy 4 Paul tells the widows to remarry, so he can't be against the idea of remarriage after the death of a spouse. So that only leaves a third alternative, that he is saying that they should be married. That leaves two alternatives. It should be married. However, there is an easier way of saying that than the one he chooses. He chooses a very circumlocutory fashion to say that they should be married. And again, he uses the phrase of the widows, and of course you can't be a widow without having been married, at least don't think so. So I take it that what he's saying is that you should be faithful in marriage. That's got to do with your faithfulness in marriage, that you're not to actually be a divorcee who has remarried and remarried and remarried, but that you should have been faithful to your one wife. Once, of course, she is dead, she is no longer your wife, because you are no longer married, you are then a widow. Or a widower. And so it's not referring to the remarriage after death, but the remarriage while alive, because that would then set an ungodly model within the congregation.
Thank you.
Well, Clive's question was, can we expand a little bit on the idea of putting in the new Christian into leadership and the dangers that involved in that as opposed to putting a mature Christian in? It comes particularly in the last week's passage in verse 6. He must not be a recent convert or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. Now, what the judgment of the devil is a bit questionable. It can be that he will come into the pride with which the judgment fell on the devil, or it could mean that he will fall into the devil's camp. But either way, leadership produces with people certain new temptations. And with those temptations, those who are recent converts are less likely able to cope with them. Such as pride, yes. Such as thinking that you're indispensable. Everybody who takes on leadership and who runs a ship for a little while thinks that the ship won't go without him. It takes a certain degree of Christian maturity to perceive that God is running the ship, you're not. And therefore, like everybody else, you know, the graveyard's full of indispensable men, you can be removed and the ship will go on without you quite adequately. That basic fundamental humility is required in the job, lest you get burdened down by it and you get robbed of you the pleasure of the work, and a whole range of other problems will set in. Those of us who have hung around Christian circles for any length of time outside this congregation will know the unhappy track record of new converts who have been made Sunday school teachers and fellowship leaders. And within a year or two, they get thoroughly browned off with the whole thing. And within a couple of years, they're unlikely to actually be in Christian circles at all. It just happens over and over again. But the great problem is that you have needs. You can always see more things for the gospel to be done. You have people in front of you who, in their new conversion, are very keen and zealous. And therefore, you're tempted to say, yeah, well, why don't you get stuck into it? But you've got to care for the person that you're asking to do the job as much as you care for the job to be done. And it's very hard. It's hard with some of you, I know, because I haven't asked you to do anything, and no one else in this church has asked you to do anything ever since you've been converted. And you've been converted 2 years, and you wonder why did you never get asked to do anything. It's because we love you. That is why. If we didn't love you...
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.